from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The National Science Foundation, the government's research engine, learned of its big budget cuts this week. America has already lost ground in science and math test scores, new patents, published research, and Nobel Prizes. This latest news is yet another setback for American innovation. Tonight on Point, the ominous consequences of America's slide in the sciences. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where there were more changes in the Bush cabinet today. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson stepped down from his post, bringing the total number of cabinet resignations to 8. Also today, President Bush nominated former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik to be his next Secretary of Homeland Security, replacing the outgoing Tom Ridge. And the White House made it known that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld will stay on. Joining me from Washington to talk about the developments is Thomas Frank, Washington correspondent for Newsday. Thomas Frank, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
So here we have a trio of developments. And maybe with the biggest long-term consequences still unfolding, Donald Rumsfeld is going nowhere in spite of the fact that 8 people have gone. Was there a real question about this?
I think there was a question because he's old. He's one of the oldest defense secretaries ever. And
72 now.
72. He's been controversial. There have been a lot of concerns about the war in Iraq, and I think it was natural for people to question it. But I think the difference was that he clearly wanted to stick around, and the other people who have left clearly didn't.
Famously good bureaucratic infighter, and he's still in for the ride, the president said, to keep the effort in Iraq going and to complete the transformation of the military that he's been so involved in. We'll see more unfolding on that front. Then comes former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson, 63, was 14 years as governor of Wisconsin, said that he thought about leaving the cabinet a year ago, but he's doing it now. And how's that being interpreted, Thomas Frank?
It's not really surprising. I think people knew that he had he just didn't have a very visible presence, and I think he felt like he was being thwarted by the administration fairly early on. He had wanted to do some regulations concerning tobacco and was stopped from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So he seemed like a fairly defeated person fairly early on in his tenure.
But going out today with some fairly alarming warnings about the security of the nation's food supply, its vulnerability to terrorist attack.
He's been saying that for basically since 9/11 or since the anthrax attacks, that it's the inspection system can't nearly match the volume. And of course, HHS head, he oversees the FDA,
right,
which inspects all non-meat and dairy foods. I think his comment was, I don't understand why it hasn't happened already.
So another warning on the way out the door from Tommy Thompson, who wasn't able to close that vulnerability. And finally, from your backyard at the Department of Homeland Security, Bernard Kerik, 49 years old, replacing Tom Ridge. He's the former police commissioner in New York. What kind of reputation does Bernard Kerik bring to this job?
Controversial, in a word. He has an image and a reputation for being no-nonsense, get the job done. But he's also, there's been a lot of controversy about him. He was fined $2,500 for while he was police commissioner for using police to help research his memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
He spent less than 6 months in Iraq trying to set up the police force over there, and a lot of people feel that he didn't really do a good job, that he left before he should have. And, of course, the police force is still struggling to fight the insurgency, and most of the fighting is still being done by the U.S. military.
And what about his time as police commissioner in New York? He was there in that role when the 9/11 attacks hit. He left just 2 months later. Why?
Well, that was after Mayor Giuliani was leaving office. I mean, I guess there's some question about whether it was just because he was resigning as his mayor was leaving, but I think there was also a question about whether his successor, Mayor Bloomberg, really wanted him.
And so off he went, a kind of a political transition there, and yet notable that in the middle of that turmoil, just 2 months after the attacks, he would have moved on. He was also head of corrections for New York. What kind of reputation did he have there, Thomas Frank?
Well, that was a long time ago. I honestly haven't covered him that far back. I'm sorry, I can't give you a good answer on that.
We're just hearing interesting things today. An especially controversial time. He talked about whacking people that he didn't want on the force. I mean, he simply meant firing them. But this is kind of up from the streets guy. Mm-hmm. By no means a sophisticated political player like Tom Ridge was, but he was very active in President Bush's presidential campaign effort.
And people are saying that's what got him in. Bernie Kerik is tied very closely to Rudy Giuliani, and of course Mayor Giuliani was the strong supporter of the president. And Bernie Kerik went out there, did a lot of campaigning, did a lot of work for Bush, responding to the criticism from police unions that the president hadn't done enough to fund first responders like police and firefighters. He played a very active role. He spoke at the Republican National Convention. And a lot of people see this as payback because there were other people in the Department of Homeland Security who might have been more traditional or logical choices, like the deputy secretary who had been head of the Transportation Security Administration, the former Coast Guard commander. So this is not a conventional choice.
But a political loyalist, someone very close to the president's reelection campaign, and now on the U.S. cabinet. Thomas Frank, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Thomas Frank is Washington correspondent for Newsday. He spoke with me from Washington. America is losing its dominance in innovation. The country's once tight lock on the world's best science and technology talent is slipping. Top foreign students have new opportunities in their own countries. In a post-9/11 world, it's harder for them to come to America. And America's students aren't filling the vacuum. Our guests tonight, the president of Caltech, the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, and a former top officer at Microsoft, have helped keep this country at the forefront of science and technology. But they warned that America is lagging now as other countries race ahead. Tonight on Point, America's declining dominance in science and technology and its ominous consequences. You can join the conversation. Do you remember when science was America's pride and joy? When America celebrated engineers, went to the moon, and conquered the world economy, why have we let our national science competitiveness slip? Have Americans forgotten what it takes to win and keep winning? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is David Baltimore, president of the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, and the winner of the 1975 Nobel Prize in Medicine. His essay, When Science Flees the U.S., The Trend Could Have Ominous Consequences, appeared in Monday's Los Angeles Times. David Baltimore, wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with me from Seattle, Washington, is Robert Herbold, former chief operating officer of Microsoft and a leading member of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. He is chair of the Council's Workforce Education Subcommittee, which released a report this summer titled Sustaining the Nation's Innovation Ecosystem, Maintaining the Strength of Our Science and Engineering Capabilities. Robert Herbold, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Later in this hour, we'll be joined by Shirley Ann Jackson, president of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences. But I want to dive in with these two distinguished guests we've got with us right now. David Baltimore, you sounded a pretty loud bell, and I'm sure it's not the first time you've done it this week in the LA Times. It happened to come in the week that we learned that the National Science Foundation's budget has taken a hit in an omnibus bill where there's all kinds of money for pork barrel projects, but not for science. What's the fundamental warning that you're delivering, David Baltimore?
The warning I'm delivering is not only that America is not training enough of its own people for science and technology and now can't bring enough people into the country, but also that particularly the dominant countries of Asia, India, China, and the smaller countries too, are advancing very rapidly, and we're helping them. We're helping them in lots of ways. We trained a lot of their people. We are outsourcing a lot of our own technological needs to these countries. It's cheaper there and apparently just as effective. And so we are setting the stage for finding ourselves in a global competition that we may not win.
And that sits just as plain as a nose on our faces? It's that clear and that stark?
I think it is. I don't think that any of the trends that I've talked about in this article are particularly controversial. In fact, my own thinking in this matter got a big boost, maybe in a negative direction, from Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who is in the process of writing a book, but gave a précis of that book at a conference I was at. And he came to very much the same conclusions, probably with more knowledge.
Robert Harbold, we for a long time have known, now it seems like at least a decade, and of course before that, but for the last decade, India, China, the four tigers in Asia even earlier, making big advances. But there was a sense that the United States sat on a mountain of science and technology and tertiary education so high that we had a certain kind of invulnerability, that our lead was so great that it would stick with us. The report you gave to the president this summer said no, that the risks are real and at this point pressing.
Absolutely. What's at stake is our global leadership in innovation. If you look back at the last 100 years, this country invented the auto industry. This country invented the steel industry, the chemical and materials industries, the pharmaceutical industry, information technology, biotech. In each case, the core inventions that support those industries are primarily based on solid science and engineering skills. We're at risk. Just to be specific about that risk, we are massively losing our share of science and technology and engineering talent on a global basis. If you look at the United States today, for all the bachelor's degrees that we grant each year, currently we're running at 5% of them being engineering degrees. In China, 39% of their bachelor's degrees are in engineering.
I saw that number. It's just a shocking contrast. 5% in the U.S., 39% in China. Is there any ameliorating context for that? Is there any reason that it could be okay for the U.S. to have 5% engineers and China 39%?
Well, when you look at the numbers in the absolute, this is data from 2001 and 2002, the United States was generating about 59,000 engineers per year. China was generating 220,000 engineers per year. South Korea generating about the same number as the U.S. Taiwan, representing a country with a population of only 20 million people, generates half the number of engineers that the U.S. does. So we aren't even in the same league anymore in terms of generating talent. But it gets worse. Let me talk about PhDs at the physical science and engineering level in that curriculum area. The reason why I focus on physical science and engineering is if you step back and ask, what are the technologies and areas where raw innovation in those areas has the chance to spawn gigantic industries? Mm-hmm. It's usually those.
There it is.
Mm-hmm. 1987, there were 4,700 U.S. citizens that got such PhDs. In 1987, there were 5,600 Asian citizens that got such PhDs. In 2002, 4,400 U.S. citizens got such a degree. In other words, about the same as 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Asian citizens, 24,900.
Many, many times multiple.
Correct. Five or six times the number. Now, in many cases, the reason for this is that the universities have really grown in Asia and become quite substantial in terms of their ability to turn out really strong students. Secondly, they have a home ethic and a country ethic that really values these things.
We've got to take a short break here, but David Baltimore, in a word before we go, is this a long-term problem or is it right in our face? David Baltimore.
If we don't face it right away, we're in big trouble.
We'll come back and look at exactly that. David Baltimore, president of Caltech, at Robert Herbold of Microsoft. Please stick with us. We're talking tonight about America's innovation dominance and economic standing at risk as the country loses its lead in science and scientists. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember when science was America's pride and joy, when America celebrated engineers, went to the moon, conquered the world economy? Is America today even coming close to maintaining its lead, or is it living off the accomplishments of the past? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's innovation dominance and economic standing, fundamental economic standing at risk as the country loses its lead in science and scientists, in technology and technologists. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you think America can maintain its global leadership, its standard of living without dominance in science and technology? And why are Americans turning away from scientists, from science? Why have we let our national competitiveness slip? We've been joined tonight by Nobel Prize winner David Baltimore. He's president of Caltech. Also from Seattle, Washington, by Robert Herbold, former chief operating officer at Microsoft. I apologize. And member of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. We're joined right now from Boston by, by Shirley Ann Jackson. She's president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, president of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. She was the first black woman to earn a Ph.D. from MIT, the first black woman in the country to earn a physics doctorate. She's spoken extensively about what she calls the quiet crisis in America. Shirley Ann Jackson, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You've put it in this phrase that the U.S. is facing a day of reckoning if it doesn't nurture young scientists and engineers more effectively. David Baltimore and Robert Herbold have begun to lay out for us just how severe the problem is. What's your interpretation of why the pipeline is not being filled by young American scientists, engineers, technologists at the top level?
Well, I think there's some subtle points, and then there's some less subtle points. Let's start with the more obvious ones. I think we as a country have not done all that we can and should to build and maintain a pipeline of students, to maintain interest of students. Secondly, we have a relative underperformance of American students vis-a-vis international measures of achievement in science and math, which are fundamental precursors to entering a science and engineering profession.
Just worst scores right across the board in science and math.
That's correct. A third factor is that in a subtle way, we've been very dependent, particularly at the graduate level and for advanced degree holders, on international students, which I feel has led us to under-focus on our own domestic workforce, as well as not recognizing latent talent in hitherto underrepresented groups. And by that, I mean women and minorities. And in the case of minorities, they're ones who are subject to some of the worst early educational experience.
And put that all together, and you've got a real problem. David Baltimore, I'm struck at how we hear in political debate lots of talk about education, and we've got to do better, no child left behind. But there's a certain theoretical quality about it. I mean, parents want their kids to have good education, but it's fascinating to me tonight to hear you and Robert and Shirley Ann right on the front line, scientists at the cutting edge, saying this isn't a kind of general abstract problem. It's an immediate problem.
It is an immediate problem, and it derives from all sorts of sociological aspects to life in America today. I'm not a great sociologist or psychologist, and so I'm just guessing at the kinds of things that are involved. But I think they are an inability of parents to pass on to their children a work ethic. I think it's an inability of children, or lack of desire of children, to go into difficult areas of education that require them to stay home and work instead of running off and going to the movies or watching sports games.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem of who our heroes are. There's no Einstein today. Sputnik was a moment when America focused on what could happen if we were great in science and engineering, and many people moved into science. The government supported that in a very direct way.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly right about the No Child Left Behind. It does feel more theoretical than anything else, and it certainly doesn't emphasize science and technology in a way that's going to bring people in. It's not easy to convince people to live a life of science. It's very demanding. It takes a lot of training. Many of us did it. We're all extremely fulfilled by it. We try to tell every student we run into how fulfilled we are by the training that we undertook. But that message is harder and harder to get through.
When I read you writing on this front, the what you call the inability of parents to pass on a work ethic, a lack of will when it comes to imposing discipline on children, quoting you here, and even you see you're galled at the denigration of the word stress, I guess referring to the fact that, that stress comes with hard work, and there's still a lot of hardworking people out there in this country, but maybe more at this point in Asia, in the sciences. I mean, there's a real cultural ball of wax here that looks like a very concrete impediment to getting this back on track.
There is, and I'll be honest with you, I was a little uncertain about whether I should put this on paper, largely because I'm not a real expert in these areas, and I'm speaking from my heart rather than from a deep knowledge. But in my heart, I really believe that we are putting emphasis on the wrong things. By emphasizing a minimization of stress, we're saying it's a good thing to just relax and not work hard. We should be thinking about it in just the other way.
Shirley Ann Jackson, excuse me, David,
yeah,
I know
go
I've
ahead.
Only got Shirley Ann for another minute here.
Okay.
How do you see this? Is the solution in recreating the structures of science and technology education, or does it have to be more fundamental than that? Does it go back to culture? And if it's culture, what on earth is going to change that? Is there a shock to the system or a charismatic call that you can imagine that would turn this around in a time frame that would spare the U.S. a grievous blow to its economy coming up?
Well, I think there's been a lot of research on what to do. There's anecdotal evidence from any number of great programs that are structured to get young people interested in science. But I think you have a couple of factors that need to come together, and all of those factors in the end require national leadership. And the factors that I'm speaking of briefly are the following. First, there needs to be more public recognition and understanding of science and the technologies that flow from that and what that really has meant and continues to mean for this country. Secondly, we have to begin to build the pipelines again and meet young people where they are. Now, I'm not one to talk about people's life circumstances, to working parents, and so on, but I do believe that we do need to focus on having rigorous early curricula for young people in science and math. I'm one who believes in having discipline-based teachers, particularly beginning in middle school and upper school. I think we have to, further along the pipeline, provide more encouragement and financial support for graduate study for American students. Mm. And we need to recommit to investing in basic research across a very broad front.
I know I've just got you for another half minute here. What's your sense about what it might take to make these changes? People talk about them a lot, but actually making them happen, do you think, Shirley Ann Jackson, that the U.S. is going to have to face that day of reckoning you described before it dramatically shifts gears to attempt to produce that pipeline of science achievement?
Well, I would like to hope that we don't face a day of reckoning, because it takes a long time to build a scientist. It takes a long time to build scientific and engineering infrastructure that allows one to be at the leading edge. But what it will take in order for that day of reckoning not to happen is national leadership, national will, a recommitment at the highest levels to working across a broad front to deal with the human resource issues, to recognize what other nations are doing, and to address the question of underinvestment in basic research across a broad range of disciplines.
National will at the highest levels. We'll be hearing more about whether or not we're seeing that lately. Shirley Ann Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
David Baltimore, Robert Herbold, I want to begin to bring our callers in. There are a lot that want to join this conversation. Jose is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Jose. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Great show. I listen to you almost every day. I'm actually in the science, technology, and policy program here at WPI in Worcester,
okay.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, and what do you see?
And I beg your pardon?
What do you see there, Jose?
Well, you know, I heard like 2 minutes of the program on and off, and I said, I've got a call. Because my question is, how do these relative gains from other countries matter when we are clearly ahead of everybody else in innovation? And then the cycle of passing, say, lab research to you know, and products, we're still leaders in that. And then are you measuring these gains based on science? That is, this is something that I feel needs to be discussed. Is if you open today in America, and I'm speaking as an international student who came up here from Honduras, so
okay.
I've seen the vantage point of America's dominance versus, say, Japan's.
And you still see innovation dominance there. Jose, let us pick it up right there, if we might. Robert Herbold, let me throw that to you, if I may. Jose looks around and says, well, you can raise whatever alarm you like. America still got the lead in innovation. Why so worried?
Well, I think the reason for the worry is you look at the trend and ask, you know, what it takes to generate innovation. And what it takes is expertise. And if you look at some of the major technology companies today, the amount of effort being put against setting up design centers to take advantage of this talent in Asia is enormous. I'm on the board of one of those companies.
That is moving research and development to Asia.
Exactly. And I'm not talking about just manufacturing. I'm talking about the design of products. I'm on the board of a company where we became so embarrassed at the high price of our products that, in fact, we asked our Chinese design team to tackle the task, and they took out 70% of the cost and generated a superior product.
Do you even agree with Jose's assertion, then, that the United States still leads in innovation?
Well, I think that in the absolute, that's probably right, just given the size of the country. But if you looked at the trends and said, once again, where is the talent emerging, that's the worrisome part of this. You know, if you go back and say, you know, what is the source of this problem? The source of this problem, one of the key ones besides the kind of issues David talked about, is let's look at what our group looked at and decided to really focus on in terms of part of our work was the K-12 teacher pool. You know, if you're a middle school student taking a science course, you have a 93% chance of being taught by an out-of-field teacher. If you're in high school,
so not even a pro. I mean,
no,
not even an educated,
even minor in the area.
Right.
And so, what's the probability that this teacher is going to fire up the student to become excited about these areas from a career standpoint? So, it's the long term trends, and as David points out, they're getting closer and closer. When you see the kind of huge numbers being accumulated in Asia and it is frightening.
Jose, we're glad you still see that eminence in innovation, but we can't help being very concerned by what we hear tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David Baltimore, I wonder if you hear this kind of pushback often, that people might have read what you wrote this week in the Los Angeles Times and then said, oh, come on, David, we've got such a lead in innovation. Yeah, they've got more scientists coming on stream in China, but there's room for everybody here. Why worry?
You know, I've had a fair number of responses to that piece. No one has said that. Now, it may just be that the people who are thinking that haven't bothered to write to me or bothered to look up my email address.
Right.
But I have not heard that. And I would completely agree with Robert's assessment that we are temporarily probably on average ahead of the world, but we're losing our edge very quickly. The cell phones that we're working with today are almost all made and now increasingly designed in China. You have to ask yourself, what is happening in America today which is unique to us?
Mm-hmm.
If I asked that question 10 or 20 years ago, there was a long list of innovative things going on in this country that were unique to us. Today, it's just not so obvious. I work a lot in biotechnology.
Yes.
Work with biotechnologists. Biology is my field. And there is one area where we are truly ahead. And if you were to look at any place, it will be in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry. And it's partly because the pricing of drugs in the United States makes it particularly attractive to develop drugs here.
Mm-hmm.
But is it because there's no talent abroad? No, not at all. And in fact, if you look at the people doing the work in the United States today, many of them are Chinese and Indian by background. Many of them are people have come to the United States and we've trained. Some fraction of those are going back. And I wouldn't even say that we're going to hold our edge there more than perhaps the next 5 or 6 years.
It's a pattern we've seen before, and their own home countries are becoming very attractive. Dale is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Dale. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a PhD chemist by training, and
Bless you, Dale. Bless you. It sounds like you're a rare cat, and we're glad to have you there.
Thanks. But what I would like to bring up is the kind of short-sighted social nature of this country, in that if things aren't going to affect the bottom line tomorrow, that they're cut, and therefore, you know, I think our edge, where we're losing the edge, is due to the economic factors. I mean, I've had projects cut where the decision is made by someone who has no scientific training and has been out of an MBA school for a year, and they're cutting projects. And we've got, you know, I could go back and get a 2-year degree as an MBA,
mm-hmm.
and be making those same decisions that people right now are making, that I took 8 years to go through grad school and get my PhD so that I could do the science.
But you feel like the system that you're working in doesn't give you the respect to put those things front and center. We've just got a minute before the break, Dale. Thanks for that call. Robert Herbold, how about it? Dale says, look, I'm in the field, but it's profit-driven, short-sighted. Are those pressures really different here than in China? I think of China as very profit-driven, for example.
I don't think they're any different at all. In fact, I don't think you can find a more market-driven environment than Asia. And so, consequently, I think that's the exception. I think that, in general, that's not the core issue.
But you know what Dale's talking about.
Sure.
Many American scientists talk about it, and we just saw it in the National Science Foundation cuts. I mean, science taking the back seat. There's something going on there, even if it's not just the margins.
There's no doubt about that.
What is it? Why can China be market-driven and produce the scientific advancement, America be market-driven, and here's Dale saying, I feel like the science is taking a back seat?
Well, I think there's an element of complacency that goes on relative to these areas, and I think it can hurt the country. And you know, when you step back once again and say, okay, what is the core issue here? It's the fact that the population in general, as well as the area of specialists, don't have the training that they used to in these areas.
We're going to come back and look at that. Robert Herbold, David Baltimore, we're so glad you're with us tonight. We're talking about America's innovation dominance and economic standing at risk. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's innovation dominance and economic standing at risk as the country loses its lead in science and scientists. You can join the conversation tonight. Do we still have the hunger and the will to compete with the engineers of China, of India, of Taiwan? Would Americans rather slip into second-class economic status than study physics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by Nobel Prize winner David Baltimore, president of Caltech, and by Robert Herbold, who is former chief operating officer of Microsoft and a member of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Joined right now by Justin, calling from Wilmore, Kentucky. Justin, welcome. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. I was going to say that the there's an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education that actually suggests the opposite of what your experts are saying.
What's it say?
Okay, I'll just read just a quick passage. Contrary to prevailing wisdom, record number of Americans are earning bachelor's degrees in science and engineering, and unemployment rates in at least some sectors of science and engineering have topped the charts. And I was just wanting them to comment on that article.
That's an interesting observation. David Baltimore, what do you make of that? The Chronicle of Higher Education, bachelor holders in science and in engineering facing high unemployment rates? Why would that be?
I don't know why it would be, and I'm not sure I believe it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But a bachelor's degree doesn't get you to the level where you can become an innovative scientist.
I mean, I was just thinking exactly that.
You really need higher education.
Maybe those people are already outpaced by their competition abroad. Maybe, if there's a reason, maybe it's that.
Well, that is what I'm afraid may happen, is that as we outsource more and more abroad, we're going to actually find we have a surplus of people trained in science because we no longer have the laboratories to hire them.
And they aren't trained well enough to be competitive, or the laboratories, as you say, are just gone. Dan's calling from Boston. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a comment along the lines of several other people. I'm a PhD engineer, and I observe my kids have fairly in their middle school with a very good school system. And I find the budgets and the allocation of resources to science and math and education, even in a relatively privileged area, is woefully under what I experienced as a child.
So as an MIT guy, you turn around, you look at your children's experience, and even in a good school district, it's just not there. Our time is short, but Dan, let us pick that up. Robert Herbold, why should that be?
Well, I think that it goes back to the issue of the teachers and the folks that are in the K-12 system. They really have lost their interest as well as their capability in these areas, as I pointed out before.
That makes it sound like we're already into a kind of second-generation downward spiral.
We are. I mean, 1983, A Nation at Risk pointed out these problems. 20 years later, the Corrett Task Force at Hoover Institute pointed out the fact that we've made absolutely no progress on these issues. And they point to the teachers' unions, and they point to the colleges of education and say absolute stagnation. We need a system that has performance appraisals so that young people can look at this environment and say, hey, I'm one of the best and brightest. I want to go into teaching. And we need an environment where these people can make a lot of money. And the issue is not money. I mean, if the Department of Education points out that only 53% of K-12 public funding is going to instruction. The 47% is going to something else, with a big chunk of it to so-called administration. So we have to shake up that system, and we have to take some national leadership, as was mentioned before, to tackle these core issues that the unions stand so strongly behind.
Okay, I want to put this to both of you then. I mean, you say we need this. We hear about need for better education all the time, but this is need with a capital N so big it's hard to see the top and bottom of it. I mean, you're talking about fundamental national well-being at stake here and things spiraling out of the position that they ought to be in. Let me ask you this. Decades ago now, we had the challenge of Sputnik, and the whole country took the kind of shock, pulled up its socks, went to work, and produced a response that put the man on the moon and American science back in a very advantageous position. David Baltimore, first of all, can you imagine in the next decade, is there a possible equivalent to the Sputnik shock? And if it should come, is the United States in position to respond today with the kind of vigor that it did in the late 50s and 60s to the Sputnik challenge?
I think we could respond. What I can't see is what could be the equivalent shock to the system. That was at such a political level that
right.
that hit us.
The symbolism.
The symbolism. And there's nothing obvious. I suppose if somebody, China, developed a bomb with new capabilities, maybe that could scare us. But I must say I'm not sure I see it. I think what we're more likely to see is a deterioration of our position, and a presidential candidate coming along in the next couple of decades who figures out how to galvanize the country to think about these issues. We have just been through what I thought was a terrible campaign, partly because the kinds of issues that concern me, and we're talking about them here, just never were part of the campaign at all. These are overriding issues that are perhaps more important than some of the things that were discussed, although our national security is, of course, of paramount concern also.
But this is, at heart, a national security issue itself.
Absolutely it is. I completely agree. And I would like to ask Robert Herbold, whom I haven't met, and so I'm just sort of guessing.
Sure.
But you are involved at the highest levels of the administration in science and technology. Is there a recognition in Washington of the nature of these problems?
Robert Herbold?
Well, there is a head nod. If you had the folks in this conversation, they would be agreeing with us. Unfortunately, they're working in a system where it's very hard for them to do anything. And that needs to be thought about.
So how does that change? David Baltimore says get a candidate who galvanizes the nation around this.
Well,
can you imagine that? Can you imagine it?
Well, it's possible. I mean, when we talked before about what would be a national cause, there's a professor at Rice by the name of Richard Smalley who believes that the national campaign should be energy independence by 2025. He happens to be an expert on nanotechnology and believes the potential is huge.
We heard a little bit about that from John Kerry. It did not win him the White House.
No, but he didn't hit the issue hard either. And I think what David is suggesting is, do we really care about this or not? And if so, we have to make it a rallying point. But
we've got 1 minute. Is there still time if Americans in the next 5 years decided to shift gears and go for it? Is there time? China and India are never going to just lay back and lollygag. Can we recover the kind of position Americans expect to be in, Robert Herbold?
I think it's a very tough task for America because I'm not so sure they have the will.
David Baltimore, if the country doesn't recover that, is this going to be the same country in 25 years?
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. I mean, if you ask me where is my deepest concern, it's about what is the world that my daughter, who's now 30, is going to be growing up in. And that is a very big issue. I agree with Robert. I don't see exactly how we're going to turn around. I think his pointing to energy is an interesting possibility, because it is possible that we are going to be so focused on the production of energy that it actually energizes our science and technology.
With that, we're out of time. It's been a fascinating, a bit frightening conversation. We're going to have to look a lot more at this. David Baltimore, president at Caltech, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Glad to join you.
Robert Herbold, former chief operating officer at Microsoft, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. This is On Point. Twenty years ago today, catastrophe struck the city of Bhopal, India. An explosion at the Union Carbide pesticide plant there released 40 tons of toxic gas over the city. The impact was apocalyptic. Nearly 3,500 people died immediately. The number climbed to above 7,000 3 days later. Since then, more than 15,000 have died, and perhaps more than 500,000 people continue to suffer severe health effects, making Bhopal one of the worst chemical disasters in history. Victims have received some, but little, compensation. Their attempts to take Union Carbide to criminal court have so far been unsuccessful. In this radio diary, journalist and author Sukhetu Mehta describes how the survivors of the Bhopal disaster are still struggling to bring Union Carbide and its parent company, Dow Chemical, to justice.
People living in its path first felt the effects of gas poisoning early in the morning. Panic spread, and thousands started fleeing their homes.
Very difficult to explain my feelings, because we are feeling so helpless. The children are dying in front of me, and I can't do anything.
When I went to Bhopal, I didn't know what I would find. And what I found shocked me. The disaster was not over on the night that the gas floated over the city. It's still continuing. And what shocked me above all was how an entire city could be devastated and then largely forgotten. What I found in Bhopal was that it is the continuing story of not only one of the world's worst industrial disasters, but one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in human history. The role of multinational corporations in our world is a strange one. A corporation like Union Carbide can go into a country like India and set up a subsidiary and make profits while it can. But the moment something threatens its profits, it can leave the country and never be held accountable for its actions in the country. There is no international organization that regulates the behavior of multinational corporations. If America goes in and invades Iraq, then America theoretically can be held accountable in the United Nations. But if Mitsubishi goes in and destroys a Central American rainforest, or if Union Carbide goes in and destroys Bhopal, where do we go to take on Union Carbide or Mitsubishi? This is the central problem that the victims of Bhopal are facing. They have nowhere to go to take on Union Carbide. We need to make sure above all that people get justice. And above all, we need to make sure that this doesn't happen again through the enactment of laws in the developing world that hold companies liable wherever they are for the industrial accidents that they are a part of. Sajida Bano is a woman living in Bhopal who was twice victimized by the Union Carbide plant. In 1981, her husband was killed in an industrial accident in the highly unsafe plant. And 3 years later, she was coming back from a trip to her in-laws on the train with her two young children. Her four-year-old son died in the waiting room of the Bhopal train station while his little brother held on to him. When I met Sajida Bano, she asked if I would carry a letter for her to those Carbide people, whoever they are. She wanted them to hear what had happened to her. Here is her letter. Sir, big people like you have snatched the peace and happiness of us poor people. You are living it up in big palaces and mansions, moving around in cars. Have you ever thought that you have wiped away the marriage marks from our foreheads, emptied our laps of children, bathed us in poison, and we are sobbing, but death doesn't come? Like a living, walking corpse, you have left us. If this vampire Union Carbide factory would be quiet after devouring my husband, if heartless people like you would have your eyes opened, then probably I would not have lost my child after the death of my husband. I don't know myself why you have this enmity against me. Why have you played with my life so much? What did I, a poor, helpless woman, spoil of yours that even after taking my husband you weren't content? You ate my child too. If you are a human being and have a human heart, then tell me yourself what should be done with you people and with me. I am asking you, tell me, what should I do? Union Carbide never responded to Sajida Bano's letter.
Suketu Mehta is author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. He lives in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.